Good afternoon, and welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Disease of the arteries that run to our extremities can lead to pain, skin lesions, and occasionally even loss of an arm or leg. These problems are not that uncommon. Who's at risk? What are the symptoms? And what are the treatment options? Our phone numbers in Anchorage are 550-8422. If you live outside of Anchorage, you can call toll-free at 1-800-478-8255. Our email address, line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll be talking about peripheral artery disease on Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
Welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is peripheral artery disease. Our phone numbers are familiar if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, and you can email us at line1@aprn.org. My guest today is Chakri Anampudi. He's the diagnostic and interventional radiologist with Imaging Associates of Providence and the Providence, Alaska Medical Center. Before I introduce Dr. Anampudi and begin the discussion, I'd also like to just remind our listeners something very important, I think, and that's that the principal source of vitamin D for humans is sunlight, and several studies have demonstrated that Americans have insufficient vitamin D, even those who live in areas where they have much more access to sunlight than we do in northern climates. So can Alaskans get enough vitamin D, and if not, what are the consequences? Next week, my guest will be one of the world's authorities on vitamin D, Dr. Michael Hollick of Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Anampudi, welcome to Line 1 again.
Thank you, Thad Woodard. I appreciate it.
It's good to have you back. So we're talking about peripheral artery disease, and before we do that, let's define some terms. I've heard the term peripheral vascular disease, and we've actually talked about that here. What's the difference between vascular disease and arterial disease?
Vascular disease is more of a general term. We have blood vessels of two kinds, veins and arteries. Veins are the vessels that bring blood away from the organs towards the heart, and arteries are the blood vessels that take blood from the heart to the other organs. So peripheral arterial disease, or PAD, is a bit more of a specific term that implies that disease of the arteries. And peripheral vascular disease is a more general term, applies to arteries and veins. But 95% of the disease that causes symptoms that we're going to be talking about on this show and more applicable today would be peripheral arterial disease.
When we talk about arteries, I've implied in my introduction that we're talking about the arteries that go to the major extremities, both arms and both legs. Is it appropriate to also consider the head and so that stroke associated with peripheral artery disease also?
Absolutely. The term peripheral arterial disease or PAD or the less specific term peripheral vascular disease is actually coined mainly to differentiate from the coronary artery disease, which is considered the central, it's a central pump that pumps blood and receives blood. So all the arteries outside the heart are considered peripheral arteries. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, the carotid system, which is the system that supplies the brain, is considered part of the peripheral arterial system.
All right, so if we ignore the coronary arteries, those arteries that come off the aorta and supply blood and oxygen to our heart muscle, are there specific vessels, arteries, and locations on those arteries where peripheral artery disease is more common? What I'm trying to do is begin to understand what's happening, where it's happening, and why it's happening.
Very good question. Yes, we have miles and miles of arteries in our system, but the more common disease processes occur at specific locations. For example, in the arteries that supply the brain, There's a branch point in the neck, in the mid-portion of the neck, where we tend to feel the pulse. It's a carotid artery branching where it divides into the external and the internal. The internal supplies the brain. That branch point is a critical part where we tend to develop disease. And when we examine patients looking for carotid disease, that's where we look for. Does disease happen at other locations? Yes. But predominantly, that's one point where it occurs. And as you move down, it's less common to get disease of the arteries that supply the gut, like the celiac artery or the mesenteric arteries. But it's relatively common to get disease of the arteries that supply the kidneys. And as you move further down, we have the aorta. It's less common to see disease of the aorta that causes symptoms, but it's quite common to see the arteries in the iliac arteries, which are the main arteries in the pelvis, which are the main supply to both the legs, have a significant plaque and disease. And after that, as you go further down, there's a point a few centimeters above the knee where the artery turns. And medically it's called the adductor canal. So there is vast majority of the atherosclerotic plaque formation occurs, and critical stenosis develop. And then below that, below the knee, like 10, 15 centimeters, as the vessels branch out into three different branches, that's another place where diabetics tend to get severe disease.
You know, when you're trying to understand why something's happened, and obviously, you know, we're not going to figure all the science out and the things we don't know from questions that I'm going to ask today, but one of the first things that's got to jump to people's mind is why is it seems to happen, you're implying it, bifurcations where there's channels going off where the bloodstream is changing, and I'm assuming there may be some eddies of current at that point, maybe more turbulence, maybe more pressure on the walls. Are those factors that are thought to be important?
Absolutely. And from our current understanding, which I would say is still limited at this point, as you have rightly pointed out, the bifurcations get a lot of stress from the high velocity, and those are felt to be the stress areas. And when we, you know, as we developed into these higher organisms, we have also developed built-in systems to partly deal with that. For example, at the carotid artery bifurcation, the artery is actually much larger, twice the size of the rest of the carotid artery is right at the bifurcation.
So just as it begins to bifurcate, it enlarges.
It enlarges. And normal artery, normal carotid artery right at the bifurcation is twice the size.
Huh.
So you could have a significant amount of plaque build up, but still you're protected.
Mm-hmm.
That's like any other artery. So as a part of evolution, these high-risk areas are identified, probably animals that didn't have a large carotid artery origin. Maybe they didn't survive. We don't know. But so there's a lot of protective features that are built into all these vessels. I think the stresses at the bifurcation is one of the critical pieces.
And just to focus on this business about evolution, what evolution does is it picks out individuals who have a selective advantage. And so when we think of all kinds of different animals, different insects, things about our human body and what makes us where we are, is we realize that over time we're selecting out those things that have an advantage. So what you're saying is, you know, people somewhere down the line had a genetic change that caused them to have slightly larger arteries at these important areas, and that gave them a selective advantage. They were not as likely to have disease or complications that would end their life sooner so they couldn't reproduce.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. What is going on in the arteries? What is happening? Where is it? What's an artery made like? Is it movable, or is it a hard lead pipe?
The great question. I'll try to do my best to answer that. All of our arteries are made of three layers. The inner layer is called the intima, and the middle layer is called the media, self-explanatory, and the outer layer is the adventitia. Mm-hmm. Majority of the disease that we're talking about today in non-diabetics, and I'll deal with the diabetics and renal failure patients in a few minutes, happens in the intima. Intima is a thin layer of multiple cells, cellular layer, mainly composed of endothelium. And this is the inner layer. And what happens in patients who are developing peripheral vascular disease is slowly the cholesterol soft plaque starts to get deposited. And then once the soft plaque gets deposited, it builds on itself. And then it becomes hard plaque. And then slowly it calcifies. and truly becomes like a rock. So, and you could actually see the calcium on X-ray, and slowly turn into lead pipes. So this is the most common form of disease, which is called atherosclerotic disease, because it starts with atherosclerotic plaque. It's very identical. It's actually identical to the same disease process that happened in the heart, in the coronary artery disease. Because peripheral arteries are much larger vessels compared to the size of the vessels in the heart, it takes a lot of buildup before people start to have symptoms. So by the time you have symptoms in a peripheral artery, you can be guaranteed that you have a significant amount of disease, because a 50% narrowing or half of the loss of cross-section or diameter of a blood vessel doesn't give people symptoms. So it takes 60 to 70% stenosis or narrowing before you start to get symptoms. So that means that it's been a lot of plaque buildup already. So this is the most common form of disease, which is atherosclerotic disease that happens in the intima. What happens that's unique to diabetics and patients who are on dialysis and chronic renal failure, in these two subsets of patients, is they start to get a fine granulated calcium deposits in the media, which is the middle wall of the artery. And this medial calcification now turns the artery into a lead pipe. It does not actually reduce the lumen, which is the inner diameter of the vessel, but it makes it so it's not pliable. So once these people who already have these really rigid pipes, which is the best way to describe it, start to develop plaque, even a small amount of plaque would lead to a greater degree of symptoms because they have lost the flexibility of a normal artery would have. So diabetics in general are much, much greater risk because of three reasons. One is they have higher incidence of atherosclerotic disease. They have this calcium deposit in the middle layer of the artery. That's a medial calcification. And third, probably the most important, is diabetics tend to get disease of the tiniest of the vessels, which are in the tissues, which is called the small vessels, which we can't even see on a regular CT scan or MR. So the small vessel disease happens in diabetics. So the combination of this large vessel disease and small vessel disease puts diabetics and patients with renal failure at a much higher risk than the general population.
A number of questions came to my mind as we were, as you were describing what's going on there, and there's a couple issues I want to come back to, but one of them is certainly, who is at risk? And you've identified individuals that have diabetes as having perhaps a more likely complex a problem with their vessels and maybe an increased risk altogether. You didn't really say that, but I'm interested in who in particular seems to be that group of people that end up coming to physicians' attention because of progressive symptoms, which we'll get to eventually.
Yes, a good question. So the risk factors for peripheral vascular disease are almost identical to the risk factors for coronary artery disease. And if you look at the literature, the number one risk factor, again, is diabetes. And once we leave that subset of patients, and then if you take non-diabetics, the smoking is a very high risk factor. It promotes atherosclerotic disease, promotes plaque formation, and uncontrolled hypertension, or high blood pressure that's not treated, it's a high risk factor. High cholesterol, again, for unexplained reasons, it's not really clear in why some patients get plaque formation and some patients with high cholesterol don't, but high cholesterol generally is considered a risk factor. Sedentary lifestyle and obesity are also considered risk factors for peripheral vascular disease.
You know, for many illnesses, it's now becoming clear that genetic plays a significant role, and we've always got this nature-nurture argument going back and forth. And I'm going to guess, because I don't know much about peripheral artery disease myself, that that some people have a lot of risk factors and never get much in the way of disease, and some people with no risk factors perhaps may go ahead and develop it. Do we know much about the genetics, and is genetics felt to be an important issue here?
It is felt to be an important issue, but honestly, I mean, they have not identified so far any specific genes that create a protective effect. So the medical community in general and subspecialists myself, like myself, that focus on vascular disease have for now learned to focus on the known risk factors and risk modification. I see patients all the time that say, well, a friend of mine smokes twice as much as I do, and he eats very high fat, and he's fine, and he doesn't have any of the disease or problems that I do. Right. So he drew the lucky card, and he's got the better genes. Right. So that doesn't mean that we cannot modify the risk factors that we can control. So absolutely, I think down the road we're going to find out a lot more about genetics, but for now, we have to deal with what we know.
Well, let me play the science card then. I mean, we say that some people do better than others, or maybe it has to do with genes. Do we know the converse of that? Do we know that if we modify factors, if we tell people to stop smoking and lose weight and exercise, and lo and behold, they do it, do we really improve outcomes? Do we see changes in the lesions, what's going on in the arteries, or do we just improve outcome?
Absolutely, and that is the most encouraging thing, the fact that we know, because modifying risk factors does dramatically change the outcomes.
Okay.
A good control of diabetes, good control of hypertension, quitting smoking and exercise and maintaining a leaner body weight has clearly demonstrated improved outcomes and improved symptoms and reduced the need for surgery and interventions.
Let me remind our listeners just quickly, you're listening to the Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Chakri Adimpudi. He's an interventional and diagnostic radiologist here in Anchorage. And we're talking about peripheral artery disease, those vessels that supply blood to our extremities and our head, and what's causing some problems in those, and we're getting towards talking about symptoms. If you've got questions about what you hear today, there's a couple of ways you can get in touch with us to have your questions addressed. Our local number, 550-8422 in Anchorage, 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. Remember, the live program, which will be here and answering your questions, is between 2 and 3. If you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. We do have one email. I think I'll go ahead and take this. And I'm not sure it's necessarily related to this, Dr. Adimpudi, but let's see what you think. A family member has had a swollen foot since the early days of the oil spills. I think she's just dating that back to many years ago. But without any known injury or disease, it doesn't seem to hinder activities. It's not noticeable, but it is noticeable. Doctors have felt the pulse in her ankle and said it's strong, but they have not actually taken the pressure. There's no current disease except slightly high cholesterol score, which Lipitor seems to control. Should more be done to determine the cause? So this is a single swollen foot, maybe not both feet, without any other major symptoms. Does that strike you as perhaps being peripheral artery disease or something else?
Yeah, it is actually a good question because it's one of the more common questions that we get besides pain, swelling of the lower extremities of the feet. The arterial disease can cause swelling of the feet by, you know, creating tissue ischemia or lack of good blood supply to the tissue. But if as the caller says, they're good pulses. Once you have good pulses in somebody that does not have significant pain when they walk, I would say, without examining the patient, it's very unlikely that it's arterial disease. Mm-hmm. It could possibly be venous disease, which is the blood vessels that return the blood if they don't have patent valves, which, if we have time towards the end of the program, that's also an area that we focus on as part of the peripheral vascular disease. We could talk more. But it could be venous disease. Mm-hmm. And if her question is, can something more be done, I think a non-invasive ultrasound evaluation of the veins to see if there's reflux in the veins could be beneficial.
So the arteries pump these blood down to the distal extremities with quite a bit of pressure, and then there's not a lot of pressure bringing that fluid back up. And if those veins are incompetent, as the term might be used, then you might get stasis behind that and pull in swelling.
Exactly.
That's one reason.
Right.
And there may be other reasons incidentally as well.
Yeah. Feet swelling, I mean, they're 10 different differential diagnoses for that, but yes.
Okay. In coronary artery disease, again, not my area of expertise, so I always don't want to look like too much of an idiot when I ask these questions. My understanding is that at times you can have a sudden occlusion. You may build up plaque, which is this cholesterol thickening of the artery. But what often is the real coup de grace is that there's suddenly a blood clot that forms, and that's where aspirin should be given to people who are suddenly having chest pain and maybe having a heart attack. Does that same process happen in these peripheral arteries?
It does, and the characteristics of the plaque in the coronary arteries and the peripheral artery disease are very similar. But what you've just described is an unstable plaque or plaque at risk. What happens, as I talked in the early part of the program, is you build up these cholesterol plaque or. It's actually a cheesy, soft material. And on top of that, you have a cellular layer which actually separates this cheesy, soft material from the blood that's flowing. And this happens more commonly in the heart, like I just described, but all of a sudden, with no definable reason that we have not identified yet till today, and a lot of research is being done and a significant amount of imaging-guided focus is being put on this, is that plaque cracks, and then this cheesy material on the inside get exposed to blood, and that material inside is very thrombogenic. That means it forms clot. It promotes clot formation. So the platelets that are flowing rapidly normally they just go fly by, and then when they're exposed to this cheesy material or cracked plaque, they adhere to it, and it forms thrombus. And the coronary artery, being a smaller vessel, it immediately clots it off, and then you get a heart attack. That's what the suddenness of heart attack is about. In the peripheral vascular, in the peripheral arterial system, it's less recognized because we have a lot higher tolerance for lack of blood flow. The skeletal muscle of the calf or the thigh can tolerate complete ischemia for hours and days sometimes. So it's not like the heart. So the patients tend to come to attention immediately like you would have a heart attack. But the same process does happen in the peripheral arteries.
So just to clarify that in my own mind and say it somewhat differently, although you did this very good, is what can happen is that plaque gets disturbed and is injured, and you said cracks, and our bloodstream is designed let me put it this way. Certain cells in our bloodstream, certain proteins are designed, if certain things happen, to say, well, this is a cut, this is an MRI, I want to make a clot, I want to make a dam. And so it gets misinterpreted and it starts to make that clot inside the vessel, which then obstructs the blood flow very acutely at times.
Exactly.
And so if that's in a peripheral artery, what might happen in the way of symptoms?
You get sudden severe pain if more common in the legs, so we'll talk about legs. So sudden pain in the legs, and then the leg would turn pale or white and cold, and in a few minutes or a few hours, it would turn blue for lack of blood supply.
Okay. All right. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8422. Toll-free number 1-800-478-8255, and you can email us at line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails and talk with Chakri Adampudi on peripheral artery disease. For Line 1, your health connection, this is Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, your health connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Chakri Adampudi. He's a invasive interventional radiologist and diagnostic radiologist with the Providence Imaging Center and Providence Alaska Health Center. Our discussion today is around peripheral artery disease. If you've got questions or comments, you can get us by emailing at line1@APRN.org. You can give us a call at 550-8422. And our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. And remember, if you're listening after 8 o'clock on Monday night, you're listening to a recorded program, and we won't be able to answer your questions. Well, so far we've discussed what's happening in these arteries. We've identified, or you've identified, some of the risk factors for that. And we really haven't talked about the big issue that's important to me and others that are getting up in our age, and those are the symptoms. And I'd like you to really focus, if you don't mind, on what are the early symptoms, how can those be confused or misconstrued by patients and physicians so that sometimes there's an unfortunate delay in diagnosis?
I'd be happy to do that. The first symptom that most patients with peripheral artery disease are likely to get is pain in their feet, calves, or thighs, or buttocks. So any part of the leg could be involved. The pain that you get from peripheral arterial disease or peripheral vascular disease is very characteristic. It's a pain that you get with exercise or any kind of effort. When you walk a certain distance, you get pain. What it typically starts off is as a pain that you get when you walk, let's say, two blocks. That's the other characteristic of this pain is it goes away when you rest. That is because, as I've mentioned earlier, it takes a lot of plaque buildup in a peripheral artery for it to be symptomatic, because there's a lot of reserve. These are pretty large blood vessels. So you have a plaque that's, let's say, plaque that's narrowing 60% of the blood vessel that's supplying the calf, for example. When you're at rest, this artery is maintaining the blood supply that's needed for the muscle to breathe and oxygenate normally. But when you start to exercise, the muscle's demand for oxygen goes up. Mm-hmm. And then the muscle starts to demand more blood supply. But because of the constriction in this artery cannot keep up because now it's restricted. It's like putting your thumb on a garden hose because there's no more blood that's coming. So now the muscle is now craving for oxygen, and it releases these chemicals that cause pain. So because basically the muscle is starving for oxygen. So when you rest, the demand for oxygen in this muscle goes down to normal baseline levels, and the artery now can keep up. So your pain goes away, and typically it's the lactate that gets washed out of the muscle. So that classic pattern is called claudication. So the pain that you get with exercise that goes away with rest. And, you know, pain of other sorts is quite common. So it is very common to get leg pain from other symptoms. It could be, you know, your back, pinched nerve, or legs being tired. But, for example, if it's just aching muscles, they could be aching at rest. Mm-hmm. So they're not necessarily related to exercise. Mm-hmm. And if you get up in the morning and if you have pain, it's not claudication. Mm-hmm. So there are a variety of things you can look for, but you mainly look for the characteristics that I mm-hmm. just described. For mm-hmm. pain, if there's one take-home message, I would say look for pain that you get with exercise that goes away with rest. That's classic claudication.
Which is very similar to what happens with coronary artery disease.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So the muscles are saying, I've got increased demand and it's not being met. And is the pain, you mentioned the pain is due to a breakdown of metabolism, lactic acid. Is that the cause of the pain, you think, or do we know for sure what causes the pain?
The current theory is just that. It's uh-huh. very similar to, you know, when you do heavy exercise, you get lactate buildup in the muscle. So you acutely get the metabolites in the muscle that are not washed out with good blood supply. And so that's the first symptom that you get, which is claudication. Okay. It typically starts off at, let's say, two blocks, or if you're a runner, you can't run as distance. So it starts off at a certain level, and then it gradually gets worse. As the artery is getting narrower and narrower, a two-block claudication now becomes one-block claudication, and a one-block claudication becomes half a block claudication. and then it proceeds to be rest pain. So those are the grades of claudication that we look for. They can be asymmetric, actually more common they're asymmetric, that only one leg is affected.
Ah, good, because both of my legs ache like crazy after one. Okay, go ahead.
So it's common for them to be asymmetric. So if patients have, you know, pain and symptoms in just one leg, it is a characteristic of peripheral vascular disease. And most commonly what I see is when patients have symptoms more in one leg, that leg is stopping them from going any further, so the other leg is not being tested. Mm-hmm. What I see is, you know, when we treat that leg with, you know, angioplasty or stenting or laser or any of that, then they come back six to 8 weeks later saying, Doc, this leg is doing great, but now I got new symptoms in this leg. And they think it suddenly happened since I treated. They always wonder if it's the cause of the treatment.
Well, that's the way we think.
Yeah.
Can't be my fault. that makes sense.
So, but when we explain to them, it makes sense to the patients too.
Sure. Yeah, it's one of those situations where the intuitive way you think about it is not the correct way to think about it. Another thought I had about, or question I had about pain, is sometimes pain worsens if you continue to do the activity. And I don't know that I've ever related that necessarily to coronary artery disease or peripheral arterial disease. So you've said you start having discomfort, but what if you continue to work through it? Does the pain continue to get worse, or is that not necessarily true?
In an acute situation, like on that given day, the pain would continue to get worse.
Okay. All right.
But the recommendation for exercise is, let's say you have a two-block claudication. So you walk to a point where you're about to get pain, and then you stop, and then you walk again. The reason for that is, you know, our bodies have these inbuilt great mechanism to bypass almost anything or trying to, you know, make up for you know, loss of that artery, for example. For example, the artery that's supplying blood to the calf is narrow. So the body knows that it needs to now build collaterals. So it needs that stimuli, the body needs that stimuli or the chemical stimulus to build those collaterals. So if you're not exercising at all, the body does not get that stimulus to build those collaterals. But if you're exercising to a point that you're just about to release those chemicals or release those in a low dose, then it develops those collaterals. So after a while, you keep doing that. Now, one block claudication, you exercise regularly. Now you can make it into two blocks by building collaterals. Very similar to the exercise rehabilitation that's promoted for the heart. So the same thing. You exercise the heart and try to build collaterals.
So the reason exercise helps us is not that it helps the problem in the artery that's there. It induces the body to fix itself by making new streams around the block.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's like diverting traffic.
All right. So someone's got intermittent claudication or doesn't have intermittent claudication. What's the next kind of symptoms that might be noted? I want to take us up fairly quickly up the chain of downside to this disease.
Yeah, absolutely. And intermittent claudication is the most common symptom, but doesn't always show up because, let's say, for example, the patient or an individual doesn't exercise much at all. Leads a very sedentary life, doesn't even do half a block.
Right.
But the artery continues to narrow down and because it's doing its disease thing. And so now we go on to the next stage, which is the tissues are not getting enough blood. Now you start to see skin changes in skin color, you know, redness or erythema, and then the skin starts to break down, and then you develop ulcers, and followed by gangrene, which would be dead tissue, and which most commonly is the toes, which are the farthest away from the blood supply, and you'd start to have blue toes and ulcers and loss of tissue and potentially amputation.
I would think that's a greater risk for diabetics, since you've already kind of talked about how the smaller vessels are greater. Is that true? But can it happen in individuals who don't have diabetes as well?
It's less likely in individuals that don't have diabetes not to have claudication, but directly to have rest pain. It's more common in diabetics for a couple of reasons. One is they already have small vessel disease, which is makes it harder. Even if they develop collaterals, they still have small vessel disease. And the other reason is diabetics, severe diabetics, have a component of neuropathy. So the pain is less of an issue in diabetics, or they may not recognize or perceive pain. And so that's another issue with diabetics. So because of these multiple reasons, yes, we see more tissue loss in diabetics.
Remind our listeners again, we're talking about peripheral artery disease. If you've got questions or comments, a couple of ways to get a hold of us in Anchorage, 550-8422. Outside of Anchorage, 1-800-478-8255. And you can email us at line1@aprn.org. I'm going to stop right here and just take a email that we've got. It says, please comment on research that's happening that's going into these occluded arteries and how to reduce or eliminate or build up, get rid of some of this plaque. So the question is, what can be done? We've kind of alluded to some preventative things that have been shown to be effective. But what else do we need to know about that?
So that comes into a medical management of peripheral artery disease.
Okay.
You know, you go into the doctor's office, you know, they check the pulses, you have poor pulses, or you have classic symptoms of claudication. They've determined you have peripheral artery disease. One of the first things that's recommended is control of the three things: the blood sugar, hypertension, and cholesterol. And if you have high cholesterol and if you have peripheral artery disease, aggressive cholesterol management is recommended. And it is shown to reverse all the soft plaque. Once it's calcified and hardened as a rock, it's less likely to reverse. But the soft plaque can be reversed by controlling cholesterol and also controlling blood sugar if you're diabetic, and good control of your high blood pressure. That is a medical management, and also we have medications that actually make the red blood cells more flexible, so the red blood cells can carry this oxygen beyond some of the smaller vessels. So medications like Pletol and they can also help.
All right. So we've talked about symptoms. Let's move on to diagnosis, because I want to leave plenty of time to talk about treatment options. So someone comes in and it has symptoms of intermittent claudication or has some of the more later symptoms. What's the natural process of evaluating those patients?
A good question. The first step in evaluating for possible peripheral artery disease is taking good pulses. It sounds very simple, you know, and it is.
And cheap.
And cheap. and for most people could probably even do it at home.
Yep.
But it's interesting that research was done even in, actually especially in busy primary care and family practice settings. Only 50% of the patients actually get their pedal pulses examined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we have all these monitoring systems. You know, before the doctor comes in, your heart rate, you know, your blood pressure and your EKG, everything's taken care of. Mm-hmm. So it's even rare these days for a physician for a variety of reasons to actually lay hands on pulses, because traditionally pulse taking was for measuring the heart rate. Mm-hmm. Now we have all these electronic gadgets that are already given to the physicians. So it is not common that you know, patients' peripheral pulses don't get checked. But if peripheral artery disease is a concern, or even if you're in that age group of 55 plus, where it's a high risk, it's very, very important to check the pulses. Obviously, it starts with the radial and ulnar pulses, because to make sure that even though it's less likely to get arm peripheral artery disease, they form kind of the baseline to evaluate your legs against. Because you got to have.
And can give you some comparison.
Exactly.
Yeah, as well.
And I'll get into that ankle brachial index down the road. So checking the peripheral pulses, and then checking the pulses in the groin. And we have two arteries that come pretty superficial in the groin. They're called the femoral arteries. The physician or the healthcare provider would check those pulses. And then we have two pulses behind the knee, which are a little difficult to feel, and especially very hard to feel in patients who are a little bit overweight. But the two most important distal pulses, there's one behind the ankle, on the inside of the ankle, immediately behind the bony prominence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called the posterior tibial artery. That's a pulse that we should be able to easily feel. And there's another pulse. It's called the dorsalis pedis artery, and that's on top of the foot, And in between the first and the second toes, if you run a couple of inches behind towards the ankle, you'll feel that pulse there. So these two peripheral pulses are very important. If you have good palpable pulses, almost equal to your pulse in the wrist, by the feet, it is very unlikely that you have peripheral artery disease that can be treated. Mm-hmm. You can still have the small vessel disease we talked about in diabetics and in renal failure patients, but there are no specific treatments for that, and it's unlikely. But you could still have peripheral artery disease, but it's unlikely that you'd have significant peripheral vascular disease that can be treated. Mm-hmm. So it's a very simple way to evaluate it. You could have a family member do it or make sure that your doctor is reminded or requests that be done. So that's the first thing.
So you're not feeling the vessel and what it feels like as much as you're just saying there's a good pulse there that's at least somewhat equivalent to what's going on in the upper extremity there.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking more about, you know, what can be done in the least invasive manner.
Right. Yeah. Cheap screen, not much side effect.
Exactly.
Yep, love it. Okay.
And then that's the basic thing. And then let's say you go to your doctor or your healthcare provider or you do it yourself, then you're not feeling a pulse or the pulse is weak. Then you go on to the next step, what is called an ankle brachial index. Ankle self-explanatory. Brachial refers to the Latin term for the arm. So you're basically comparing the pressure in the arm to the ankle. So an ankle brachial test would be ordered. It's an invasive, it's a non-invasive test. They put blood pressure cuffs and then inflate these blood pressure cuffs to a point that the pulse gets cut off, just like taking blood pressure. And then they'll determine the pressure in the arms. They'll do it in both arms and then both ankles. So the ratio should be almost one or a little over one because it's a little harder to compress the arteries in the ankle than it's to compress the arteries in the arm. Okay. So around one is a good number. And anything about 0.9 is considered normal. And then we start to grade. So if the ratio falls below 0.9, I mean, it'll have mild, moderate, and severe disease. And anything less than 0.5 at some institutions and 0.4 at some, it's kind of a borderline criteria there, it would be considered severe.
Mm-hmm.
So if your pressure in your ankle is less than half of the pressure in your arm, then you have severe peripheral vascular disease.
Okay. All right. Both fairly simple tests. All right. So you fail those. What's next?
Yes. So now you've reached a fork in the road. So you fail those, you have peripheral vascular disease, or you're not sure you have peripheral vascular disease because you may have failed because your arteries are too difficult to compress, diabetes. And then a non-invasive way is what's preferred. Like 6 years ago, if you asked me this question, I would say, okay, patients go to the catheterization lab. We stick the artery and put the dye. It's an invasive procedure. All invasive procedures can have a little bit of risk. But now we have non-invasive methods of evaluating patients. It can be either a CT scan or an MRI. And I said either because they're areas, both of them can be used. And then I'll talk about which patients are better for what. If you're a diabetic or a patient with renal failure, and if you have very poor ankle brachial indices, you more than likely have a lot of calcium buildup already in these arteries. And a CT scan in that situation is not very good because CT scan, the calcium shows up as bright in a CT scan, as does the intravenous contrast or called dye that also shows up bright. So that it's hard in the CT scan to differentiate between these two, if it's a flowing vessel or not. But in MRI, the contrast shows up white and the calcium shows up as black. So in a patient who's likely to have calcified blood vessels, then we'd recommend doing an MRI or MRA specifically. So MRA stands for magnetic resonance angiography. So it's a non-invasive study. You give small amounts of contrast through the arm vein, and then you take a picture. And you get a beautiful picture all the way from your diaphragms down to the toes, and you get a good evaluation of your peripheral arterial system.
Mm-hmm. Ultrasound's ever helpful?
Absolutely. Ultrasound is very helpful. Duplex evaluation of the arteries. So you basically insinuate the entire arterial system with the ultrasound. Ultrasound is, again, non-invasive, doesn't even involve the dye that the CT or MR does, is less expensive, and by a lot actually considered probably the next step after ankle brachial indices. I should have mentioned that. But the one thing about ultrasound is it is operator dependent because you have to look at every centimeter of the artery by duplex, and you can miss a lot of the segments, and also it provides less specific information with an ultrasound. So I typically use ultrasound more for follow-up. Once I know that the patient has significant peripheral vascular disease because they failed the ankle brachial index test, mm-hmm. I know that they have significant peripheral vascular disease that probably would need treatment. So I have a tendency to go to CT scan or an MRI. But once I've treated them, I use ultrasound to follow up to see how well they're doing because I know exactly what they have mm-hmm. based on their anatomy. Okay. But yes, ultrasound plays a very important role.
We have 12 minutes or so. This has gone very fast, Chakri. I'd like now to just go ahead and move through quickly about treatment options. Ed, we have a couple of emails and a telephone call, but I want to make sure we get the whole breadth of things, and then as time allows, we'll answer the specific question. So you're doing a great job of helping me understand what's going on. I'm sure our listeners are the same way, but move ahead with now diagnostic, if there's anything else, but then let's talk about how our treatment options work.
Sure, thank you. So now we have done a CT scan or an MRI or an ultrasound and determined the exact location of the disease. The treatment depends on the exact location of the disease, and I've alluded to in the early part of the show that you could get abnormalities at the specific areas of the arteries. So let's start at the top. If you have tight narrowing in the iliac arteries, which are the main arteries in the pelvis that supply each leg, the most common form of treatment for those is an angioplasty and stent placement. These iliac arteries tend to be anywhere in the range from 6 millimeters in small women to almost 10 to 11 millimeters in large men. That's kind of the range. So these are, you know, even at 6 millimeters, they're almost twice the size of the heart artery of your heart. So they're pretty big vessels. So we cross the area that's narrowed, and then we put a balloon in and try and open it up. And vast majority of the times, and current data shows that just ballooning doesn't work as well as ballooning and stenting. So we'll balloon it and open the blood vessel, and then we'll put a stent. Stent is a spring-like material, identical to the stents that go in the coronary arteries. But these are much bigger, much larger stents. They mm-hmm. have a lot of radial force. So they basically tack the plaque mm-hmm. away from the artery and create the lumen that the original artery mm-hmm. is intended to have. So bottom line is, if you have iliac artery disease, angioplasty and stent placement is the current treatment of choice. There are occasions when this would not work, and then those patients would go to bypass surgery.
Okay, where you actually put in a graft around those things.
Exactly.
And all this other stuff beforehand that you talked about with stents and angioplasty is peripherally done. It's done through blood vessels.
Exactly.
Immediate question I have or concern is, we already talked about breaking that plaque increases the likelihood of getting a thrombus and platelet count. What's the risk of breaking that plaque when you put the stent in or the balloon?
Very good question. So when we do these procedures, we load the patients with heparin.
All right. We're trying to keep that from happening.
Exactly. Okay. So heparin keeps the cycle of thrombosis from happening. And if we don't give patients for heparin, I have seen immediate vessel occlusions.
Yep. Okay.
So that's for the vessels that are above the hip crease. And then the reason the angioplasties and stents work there is because these vessels are protected from the external forces. These vessels are made differently. They're not exposed to external elements or compression. Mm-hmm. But once you come below the groin level, that's been the holy grail of peripheral vascular disease till recently, till we had newer technologies came out. Because nothing really worked, because these vessels are constantly exposed to external compressions, forces, torsions, flexion and bending and crushing. So we couldn't put stents, the same stents that we put in the hearts and iliac vessels, because once you crush them, they stay crushed. So these are very rigid stents. So we had to have technology that created stents that are self-expanding. That means you crush them and then bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
So special material stents had to be made, and the Naval Ordnance Lab, like 15 years ago, developed this unique alloy. It's called nitinol. It's a nickel titanium alloy. It's very, very interesting. We probably don't have time to go into great details, but this alloy can be shaped can be formed to take any shape at the body temperature. So once it's exposed to the body temperature, it springs into a position and it stays in that position. So it's a U.S. military developed this. We call it nitinol, and now it's freely available. So now, since the nitinol stents are available, so we're starting to put stents, and we have really good data where these stents are patency rates are almost as good as bypass surgeries in the arteries below the groins.
Mm-hmm.
So we do the same thing, but as you go into arteries below the knee, it kind of gets tricky because now the vessels are 2 to 3 millimeters in size. And it's not always feasible to put large metal stents, and balloon angioplasty doesn't always work. So in those situations, you know, we use even more advanced atherectomy devices where we actually try to cut the plaque out or vaporize the plaque. We have recently, a couple of years ago, we came out. The industry came out with a device. It's a laser atherectomy. The laser is very similar to the LASIK laser that's used to do the corneal resurfacing for the LASIK surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a cool laser, and basically it vaporizes the plaque.
And cool temperature.
Cool tip. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Cool temperature, and so we use this laser to burn and vaporize the plaque and revascularize, and it's been very useful, especially in patients with advanced peripheral vascular disease, who are at risk for significant tissue loss or amputation.
And that's something that you're doing here in Anchorage right now?
Yes.
Significant complications or concerns about that, and it's just for those really peripheral lesions more so than others?
Yeah, all these devices can have potential complications, and especially that's why, you know, you need you know, there are not many people that do that. All of us that do that, and I'm not the only one. I have a lot of my colleagues and friends that do that. So they get dedicated training, and we're not allowed to even touch these stuff unless we have dedicated training and credential through the hospital. And
so you kind of got to get certified to be able to do these procedures.
Right, sure. And the hospital does a good job about, you know, who gets certified and who
Make
doesn't.
Make sure you've jumped through the hoops for them. Okay, sure. Couple of questions I want to come to. One, and this is a phone call, and I'm going to just take this because I think I understand it just to save some time. The call is, what's the difference between this peripheral artery disease and something called Raynaud's phenomenon or Raynaud's disease?
Yeah, it's a very good question, very relevant question in Alaska. Raynaud's disease is a reaction to the external stimuli. Basically, it's quite a bit different. It is part of the, you know, spectrum of peripheral vascular disease, but it's not an atherosclerotic disease. Your blood vessels constrict when they're exposed, most commonly to cold. So when you're exposed to cold weather, the arteries that are supplying your hands, they constrict, and your hands, and sometimes it can affect feet too, but less common, they turn blue and cold and painful.
And, so it's more of a spasm, but there's no reason why someone with peripheral artery disease couldn't also have Raynaud's, which would really worsen things.
Yes, exactly. And also, Raynaud's is interesting in that, you know, it happens in younger patients.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Yeah, we'll see that in children even. So.
Yeah, okay. Young adults. And I personally haven't seen it in children, but it doesn't mean... probably because of my practice patterns, but so it's a very common disease, and but you'd have to have a cold stimuli for Raynaud's phenomenon to happen.
Another question that has come up is, what about the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes and the risk of these peripheral artery disease?
It's more of a general question. The risk for peripheral arterial disease is mostly related to how long you've had diabetes and how severe you've had diabetes. You know, type 1 diabetics are more likely to have diabetes for longer, and they're more likely to tend to have more severe diabetes, just by nature. And so they tend to have more peripheral vascular disease. But but that's not just because they're type 1. It's just because they've had disease a lot longer. Type 1 diabetes, going back to the basics, is diabetes that you get for at a very young age, and then your pancreas is not putting out enough insulin. And it's also called insulin-dependent diabetes. And type 2 diabetes is you have enough insulin, but your body has a high resistance to insulin, so you have to take oral hypoglycemics to control your diabetic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, and if I made a mistake in explaining that, I'd like the people to excuse me. But in general terms, that's kind of the main difference. So you'd see if you have a family member or somebody that's taking an oral pill, they have type 2 diabetes, but they're taking insulin shots, they're type 1 diabetics. Right. Sometimes type 2 diabetes can lead to type 1 because you can become insulin dependent started off as type 2.
Right. Besides the length of time, as you've implied, that a type 1 diabetes maybe has had longer term development, what about the issue of control? That issue is now becoming increasingly an issue as we try to figure out, especially with the type 1s that have had this for a long time, would better control prevent some of the complications, the eye disease, the renal disease, the peripheral vascular disease? Do we have evidence of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So a diabetic patient with excellent control of blood glucose for most of their life are significantly less likely to get any of the diabetes-related complications. And really, that is the goal of treating diabetes anyway. I mean, diabetes is not a curable disease, because once you're a diabetic, you're a diabetic right now, there's no cure, but you just treat the disease so that you don't get significant symptoms and complications of diabetes. So control is absolutely the key.
Well, we've come to the end of another hour. This has been one of the more rapid ones. These things happen every once in a while. You've done a great job of helping me understand. I'm sure people who are listening have benefited as well. Chakri, I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful having you here. Next week, Line 1's going to return, and as I've alluded to previously, we're going to be talking about vitamin D. There's a lot of noise out there about vitamin D right now, and I've asked Dr. Michael Hollick of the University of Boston University School of Medicine to come on and talk about that. He is one of the world's experts. In particular, I want to know, and I think you might want to know, what's our risk when we live in northern climates where we have much less exposure to sunlight, as inability to maintain vitamin D sufficiency. Pat Yak is president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's show. For KSKA, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, your health connection, is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network and by Providence Imaging Center, providers of digital mammography, breast ultrasound, and MRI. Service information online at provimaging.com. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.